Good morning. The U.S. and Iran agreed to create a high-level committee to oversee whatever comes next. How are the people whose lives will be affected most seeing their future? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The President of the United States says the algae-plagued reflecting pool on the National Mall will be drained again. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Multiple people have been arrested for allegedly vandalizing the pool, although recent renovations seem to be the problem. A possible breakthrough in cancer detection, a test that screens for multiple cancers. Also, seeing Serena Williams back on the tennis court made us wonder if there are benefits to returning to a sport, even for those of us who weren't superstars. It's Monday, June 22nd. Happy birthday to Meryl Streep. Nominated for 21 Oscars and winner of 3, she is 77 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says he will resign. Speaking earlier today, Starmer says he'll step down as the head of the governing Labour Party. That means he'll end his job as the UK's leader. NPR's Lauren Freyer says Starmer was under pressure to quit.
He was elected 2 years ago with a landslide majority in Parliament, and now he has the lowest approval ratings of any prime minister in UK history. Part of it is scandals you may have heard about, his decision to appoint Peter Mandelson, a friend of Jeffrey Epstein, as the UK ambassador to Washington. But part of it is Starmer's failure to connect with people and to deliver real change that he promised.
NPR's Lauren Freyer reporting. Negotiators from the U.S. and Iran wrapped up their first high-level talks early this morning in Switzerland. Both sides have agreed to a roadmap to set out a fresh deal within 60 days. Technical talks are supposed to get started immediately. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports officials from Qatar and Pakistan are overseeing these talks.
In a joint statement, Qatari and Pakistani officials said the Switzerland summit was conducted in a, quote, positive and constructive atmosphere, and that the U.S. and Iran agreed to establish a committee that will focus on issues such as nuclear monitoring and sanctions. They also agreed on forming a temporary communication line to help avoid incidents of miscommunication and to ensure safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz. The two sides also agreed on a framework to make sure that military operations end in Lebanon, where Israel and the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah have been fighting. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on social media that major progress has been made to end the conflict in Lebanon. The discussions were strained by President Trump's renewal of threats against Iran on Sunday. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
President Trump says the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool may have to be drained again for repair. Writing online, Trump suggested vandalism could be to blame for problems with the reflecting pool. He did not provide any evidence. President Trump recently ordered a $14 million renovation of the reflecting pool. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports now it's home to a massive algae bloom.
The reflecting pool has struggled with algae for decades. Chris Gobler, a marine scientist at Stony Brook University, says warm temperatures, sunlight, and stagnant water create ideal conditions for algae blooms.
If the water there was like a fountain continuously flowing, the algae wouldn't have a chance to overgrow. You know, when you just have stagnant water just sitting there, that's the recipe for the algae just to, you know, they can replicate in hours.
In addition to the algae, some of the blue paint covering the bottom of the reflecting pool has started to peel off. Crews have been treating the water with hydrogen peroxide. Gobler says the chemical is a strong oxidizer designed to break down organic compounds, including paint. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Officials in Democratic Republic of the Congo say they've now confirmed more than 1,000 Ebola cases. There are more than 254 confirmed deaths. Healthcare officials in DRC say they fear the Ebola outbreak is spreading. Elon Musk's company SpaceX could soon end up in your retirement funds. The company's stock is up more than 23% since going public earlier this month. Some investment firms have changed their rules to let big tech companies join popular stock market index lists early. NPR Stephen Bisaha explains.
Normally, a new public company like SpaceX has to wait months or years to get into popular indexes, basically a list of differently weighted stocks that retirement accounts often invest in. But a couple of groups that run these lists changed their rules to add large IPOs much faster. SpaceX is going to be added to the NASDAQ 100 in a few weeks. That's left some personal investors concerned firms are changing rules to favor large companies. Both AI companies Anthropic and OpenAI are expected to have their own IPOs this year. Not all indexes change their rules. SpaceX still has to wait at least a year to join the S&P 500 and must prove profitability. Stephen Basaha, NPR News.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a state of emergency over a smoldering warehouse fire in Los Angeles. This provides more money to firefighters watching over the blaze. It is mostly extinguished, but there are embers, and the smoke from the warehouse fire has forced some public schools to move students to alternative sites. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
For the last day of Gettysburg, Private Marshall Sherman was hungry, dog tired, and fighting mad. The Union Army brass seemed to have a knack for sending his unit, the 1st Minnesota Infantry Regiment, to the most hopeless spot on the battlefield. Not that any location was a party, but the day before, July 2nd, 1863, they'd had to plug a weak spot in the Union line where they were desperately outnumbered. They held out, even though they lost a majority of their men. So, with just 47 members remaining, you'd think Sherman and his unit would get a pass. But the very next day, July 3rd, they were in the thick of it again. And that's when the private from St. Paul, Minnesota, did something more than survive the inferno. He seized the battle flag of the 28th Virginia Infantry. He pointed his bayonet at the Confederate color bearer and said, "Throw down that flag or I'll run you through." This same Confederate flag now resides not in Virginia, but in Minnesota at the State Historical Society.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The U.S. and Iran had a long first day of negotiations in Switzerland with the goal of permanently ending the war.
President Trump was not there, but was close to his phone and made bellicose remarks on social media that threatened to upend the talks just as they were starting. The two sides have agreed previously to a roadmap and have 60 days to resolve a host of issues.
For details, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie, who is in Tel Aviv. Greg, hello to you.
Hi, Michelle.
So they've given themselves 60 days. How did day one go?
Well, it was pretty rocky. Vice President J.D. Vance led the U.S. delegation in Switzerland and he sounded an upbeat note. But President Trump threatened in social media posts and in interviews to again attack Iran. At one point, the Iranian media said the country's delegation was walking out because of Trump's comments, though that didn't actually happen. The talks lasted into the early hours of Monday. The two countries mediating the talks, Pakistan and Qatar, put out a statement saying there was encouraging progress and the U.S. and Iran have agreed to a roadmap. This includes a working group on the war in Lebanon, which will clearly be a key part of these talks. They also set up a line of communication to deal with the Strait of Hormuz, and lower-level working groups are now set to continue meetings all week.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about all these things. I'll take them one by one. First, what is happening with the war in Lebanon?
You know, yesterday was a good day. UN peacekeepers said they did not record shooting by either side Sunday, the first such day since the fighting erupted on March 2nd. It's now midday here today, and so far it remains quiet. But it's still very combustible. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said the first real test of this peace effort is the Lebanon war. There was very heavy fighting Friday and Saturday. Israeli troops remain miles inside southern Lebanon. The Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will keep troops there for as long as it takes, he says, to protect northern Israel. Hezbollah is also defiant, saying the war will not be settled until Israeli troops leave Lebanon.
Okay, let's turn to the Strait of Hormuz. Is oil still flowing today?
Yeah, Michelle, it's a hard one. It's kind of unclear at the moment. Iran said over the weekend it was closing the strait because of the fighting in Lebanon, but that was before the fighting died down in the last day and a half. Now, U.S. Central Command says the strait remains open. Quote, Iran does not control the Strait of Hormuz. Traffic continues to flow. Now, according to groups monitoring shipping traffic, dozens of ships passed through the strait Saturday. This was one of the busiest days, maybe the busiest day since the waterway was closed nearly 4 months ago. But the traffic slowed down sharply on Sunday. We're keeping watch today, trying to see what's happening.
And, of course, the big issue remains Iran's nuclear program. Was there any movement on that front?
So a U.S. diplomat who's not authorized to speak publicly said there were, quote, robust discussions on all elements of the nuclear deal. Now, the statement by the Pakistan and Qatar mediators mentioned the nuclear issue as one of several discussed, but gave no details. It seems the immediate focus is these urgent questions like the war in Lebanon and the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. certainly expects to address Iran's nuclear program in depth and once a deal, but it may not be the top of the agenda right now.
Interesting, since that was the stated reason for starting all this. So that is NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, Michelle.
We've heard plenty of debate in the United States over the U.S. agreement with Iran. Vice President Vance has defended the agreement in many interviews. Some Republicans have cast it as a surrender, even if they originally supported the war. Some Democrats have said it's a terrible deal, yet still better than Trump's war. Now we'll sample opinions from Israel and Iran. We reached two Iranians, both of whom asked us not to use their full names out of fear of retribution. V is in his 30s and lives in Tehran.
I think a lot of people here are just relieved. Most people are just so fed up with this uncertainty for the past year that they just hope that the final agreement is reached and life gets back to normal.
While he welcomes an end to the fighting, he says many others are skeptical that it will last.
People on both sides of the spectrum still believe that this is a trap and the U.S. is going to buy some time and maybe find another excuse after the World Cup or after the midterm elections in the U.S. and start bombing Iran again.
So that's a voice from Tehran. Mehraz is in the northern city of Ghazvin. He is a writer in his 40s.
Majority of Iranian people expected the collapse of the regime. Right now, they are deeply disappointed.
Mehraz is pessimistic that life will improve for the Iranian people.
The United States has often followed a similar pattern with its adversaries. Sometimes after a change of administration, the same cycle tends to repeat itself. Negotiations, agreements, sanctions, threats of war, or even war.
Which is why Mehraz says he is indifferent to the peace talks.
It doesn't really matter to me whether an agreement is reached or not, because our opinions mean nothing to this brutal regime.
That's how some Iranians are feeling about peace talks between the U.S. and Iran. Now we have a voice from Israel, where we have reached Alon Pincus. He is a former Israeli diplomat who advised two former Israeli prime ministers and four foreign ministers. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Steve.
So I'm looking at numbers from this poll released by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and the top line is that 92% of Israelis believe that Iran won the war. I'm thinking about the old joke about the impossibility of getting any Israelis to agree about anything. 92% have the same opinion that you lost the war?
Yeah, but they each come, I would imagine, from a different angle. And they each have three angles to explain why they reached that unity or unison. But that's not the only interesting number. 72.5% of Israelis do not believe Netanyahu when he boasts about the achievements of the war. And 85%, roughly, I think it was 85, I recall from memory, you probably have the poll numbers in front of you. Mm-hmm. 85% think that no significant gains have been made. And so 92 is not that far away.
92% feel that Israel lost. Did people feel that way, though?
I don't know, a month ago when the people felt that they'd won before the peace negotiations, is what you're telling me.
Well, exactly. You just nailed it in terms of the timeline. When this war began and there was all this bravado about, you know, these monumental, heroic, glorious military achievements that both Israel and the U.S. Bragged about, Israelis were certain that, this is going to be a decisive victory. And the weeks went by, and it was less of a decisive victory. And then came April 4th, reminding our listeners that the war began on February 28th. So by April 8th, when President Trump announced a ceasefire that was then extended every 2-3 weeks, mm-hmm. And there was talk and chatter, although not necessarily definitive.
Okay, I think we're starting to lose the ambassador, Alan Pincus, but let's just listen for a moment and see if he comes back. He is a former Israeli diplomat telling us about overwhelming Israeli opinion that Israel feels that they lost the war. And let's see if Ambassador Pincus is back on a backup line. Do we have you there, sir?
Yeah.
There we go. Excellent.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Please continue. You were saying.
I'm sorry. Someone cut. I said that when the war began, Israelis were infatuated with this, with the bravado and the bragging about a decisive victory and monumental and historic. And people actually bought into the unfeasible scenarios of regime toppling, regime collapse, popular uprising, so on, and elimination of the missile program and complete destruction of Iran's nuclear program. Well, that hasn't happened. And when the ceasefire took place on April 8th, and then there was talk and chatter about a possible MOU taking shape and form, that's when those 92%, Steve, began to form. That's when people started to think that Trump wants out and the job hasn't been completed, and they can't believe Netanyahu's bragging, and they certainly don't believe Trump's bragging. And if you cut that 92% figure, a lot of people are dismayed and dejected and disappointed. And oddly enough, they don't believe Netanyahu, but they blame this on Trump.
Huh, interesting. Now, are you telling me then that in that 92%, there are a lot of Israelis who think we should continue this war? We didn't get to the end.
Yeah, but they're also realistic. I mean, you know, people don't walk around in the streets thinking about geopolitics and grand strategy. But those who do, or those who are inundated by days and weeks and months of television and radio talking heads, they understand viscerally, intuitively, that Israel can't do it alone. In fact, Israel and the U.S. could not do it combined. And that led them to think that, okay, if a war that began with Trump calling for unconditional surrender and Netanyahu more or less guaranteeing a regime collapse, if it ends with the Strait of Hormuz closed and with an MOU that allows Iran to access to billions and billions and billions of dollars, then they won the war. They upended the strategic equation. They may have lost militarily, but that doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. It's the strategic balance of power that
just got about 20 seconds. You've got elections coming up, legislative elections by the end of October. Yep. What are the political implications of this in a sentence or two?
Oh, they are huge, because Netanyahu is carrying an accumulation or cumulative burden of being responsible for the October 7, 2023 catastrophe, the Hamas attack. An impasse leading nowhere in Lebanon, and now this, which is nothing short of a strategic debacle in Iran.
Alan Pincus, former Israeli diplomat, thanks so much. This is NPR News. Hey, it's Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition. 50 years ago, KAXE became the first rural public radio station in the nation, serving northern Minnesota. 50 years ago, the first rural public radio station in the United States. Great public radio starts with a mission: to serve the community. From Morning Edition to All Things Considered to the local news and the Up North Report, KAXE keeps you informed. The goal is to strengthen civic health in rural northern Minnesota. Let's think about that, civic health, by making local government and elections more understandable and accessible and transparent before, during, and after the vote. So congratulations on 50 years to KAXE.
Your membership has gotten us here to 50 years of KEXE. Do your part. Text the word donate, 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo, who believes that AI is hard to avoid right now. That's why they made a version of their private search engine without AI. Learn more at DuckDuckGo.com. From the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, formerly Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the Public Welfare Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Blood tests currently in development may be about to transform cancer care and cancer survival. The Food and Drug Administration is evaluating a multi-cancer detection test as a breakthrough device and could approve it later this year. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
In the U.S. today, it's common to screen for five cancers: breast, colon, cervical, prostate, and lung, each requiring its own scan or exam. Compare that to Galleri, a test the FDA is investigating as a promising technology. It can detect the presence of trace remnants of malignant cells for 50 cancers from a single vial of blood. Megan Hall is vice president of medical affairs for the company Grail, Galleri's maker.
It's a real fundamental shift in how we think about cancer screening. Instead of screening for individual cancers, we can now screen an individual for multiple cancers simultaneously.
Hall says if approved around year's end, as anticipated, Medicare will reimburse its cost, which at retail is $950. So what does that mean for people who fear cancer or live with it? This month, the Journal of Clinical Oncology released research tracking the impact of Galleri's tests in real-life populations. Annual blood tests administered to 142,000 patients in the UK through the National Health Service initially turned up many late-stage cancers. But over time, as the tests caught more disease earlier, incidence of advanced cases declined.
In the third year alone, we saw a 26% reduction in stage 4 cancers: pancreatic cancer, liver cancer, lung cancer, gastric cancer, and a handful of others.
Oncologist Arif Kamal says Grail is one of hundreds of companies pursuing the promise of blood tests, competing over levels of accuracy and reliability. Kamal is chief patient officer at the American Cancer Society. He says the simplicity of such tests could make routine screening easier and more accessible.
The technology base is all there. I think right now what's happening is just updates and guidelines and practice and evidence to kind of implement that into real world settings.
Similar technology has already changed the way UCLA lung cancer specialist Jonathan Goldman treats patients. Tests can not only identify presence of cancer, but its specific genetic type, allowing for more effective, targeted treatment.
Blood-based testing has become central to the way that we think about lung cancer and other cancers because the systems have become so sensitive.
Goldman hopes the technology may one day be sensitive enough to even prevent cancer.
it's possible that at some point our blood testing could become so sensitive that you could find that very small number of cells that would be at risk for causing cancer recurrence years later.
Indeed, Grail's Megan Hall says the test shows probability of cancer and isn't a diagnosis. But fragments of DNA found in blood can narrow down a tumor's likely source.
That cancer signal origin prediction is a really important feature of the technology because it directs your physician on where to go look to confirm the presence or absence of that cancer.
And, she says, catching disease at stage 3 versus stage 4 has never been more significant for survival.
The treatment landscape has evolved so much over the past 5 to 10 years even that there are now a lot of treatments even for stage 3 cancer that offer curative intent options. And that's a really big deal.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
After nearly 4 years away from competition, a tennis great is back. And Serena Williams is back with a bang. That's Williams winning a doubles match at the HSBC Championships in London earlier this month alongside Victoria Mboko.
Reporters naturally asked what it's like coming back to the courts at age 44.
It's riding a bike up a hill, but enjoying the ride.
I love the little subtlety there. It's like riding a bike, so you don't forget, but it now feels like you're riding it uphill. Anyway, the ride continues at Wimbledon. She has a wild card entry to play doubles with her sister Venus Williams and another for the singles.
Okay, so let's say you're not a superstar athlete. Are there still the benefits of revisiting your playing past? Judy Van Rault is a sports psychologist based in Arizona.
Returning to sport is fun, and as an adult, you don't often get the chance to play. You know, a lot of work and parenting and life and all kinds of other things.
And Van Rault has some advice for getting the most out of it, like try not to make comparisons to the younger you. Instead, set new goals.
It's not always about winning and losing. It might be about improvement or coming into the net sometimes and hitting a volley or learning a new kind of spin that you weren't able to master before.
Hmm. Van Rault also believes reviving the past can help the future.
The ability to come back, to try again, to pick something up, that's a really great personal strength that could apply to your relationships. It could apply to work where something that was hard might be easier next time around.
That is Amelia Wilson's experience. She writes a newsletter called Happy on Purpose.
I began playing tennis at around 12 years old in Brisbane, Australia. And I hated the feeling that people were watching me, especially if I wasn't playing well. It crippled my confidence.
She quit after high school.
Fast forward, Wilson was in her mid-30s and living in New York as a mother of two when a friend suggested they take tennis lessons together.
And as soon as I set foot back on the court, I remembered how much I loved it. I remembered that I'd actually been pretty good at it.
And she now sees an opportunity to grow.
Being on a tennis court and feeling like you're outmatched is an uncomfortable situation, as is entering a tournament. Those uncomfortable situations and forcing myself into them has been incredibly helpful for my confidence.
And she's confident enough to write about it in a new newsletter all about tennis. This is NPR News.
Firefighters are anticipating a busy summer in the West. The U.S. Forest Service says it is ahead of its hiring goals, but some Westerners are worried by downsizing at the agency.
These layoffs at the federal level are presenting risk as to our ability to respond to major wildfires.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Concerns over wildfire staffing on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Holy cow, you guys, the World Cup is starting, and it's like the biggest nightmare and the most amazing thing all mashed together in one 6-week-long tournament. I'll let you guys jump in here a second, but I just got to get some stuff out of my brainium right now.
Let it rip. Unleash.
Well, this is the biggest event in the world. They compare every day of the World Cup to a Super Bowl, where our whole country kind of comes to a stop and people that don't even care about the sport gather in people's homes and have food and blah, blah, blah. That is every day. So this World Cup is the first one to be co-hosted by three countries, Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And boy, are there a lot of problems.
Tune in Fridays at 8:40 with DJ Dang for Football is Life. We're learning all about this year's World Cup here on People Powered KAXE.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. It is 5:29. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up in a few minutes, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this date, June 22nd. We can expect mostly sunny skies today, highs in the low 70s with light northeast wind, and tonight mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 40s to low 50s, and tomorrow we do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the low 70s. Brainerd Animal Hospital presents Pups in the Park this Saturday, June 27th from 10 to 2 at Lum Park in Brainerd. See dog demos throughout the event, plus there is a pie-eating contest for both kids and dogs, a silent auction, crafts, food, and much more to raise funds for the Babinski Foundation Animal Shelter. iLink Minnesota helps those with vision loss move forward with technology-based solutions. Your donation can help bring hope and independence. Learn more by searching for iLink Minnesota online. That's the word I, spelled E-Y-E. And Lutheran Social Services offers home ownership counseling. Non-judgmental, certified housing counselors can work with you to get your finances in order, walk you through the process, and help you calculate what you can afford. Find more about this free service at lssfinancialcounseling.org. And the call is open for Watermark Art Center's biannual members show. Artists may submit up to 2 items now through August 8th. The exhibit will run through most of September and October in Bemidji. Find an application form and more information at watermarkartcenter.org. Coming up at 7:20 this morning, it's Events Up North. Steve Noy and I will take a closer look at what's going on throughout the week. You can also find that list right now at KAXE.org. Look for Events Up North. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, June 22nd, in the year 2000, the red elderberry fruit are ripe. We have seen these plants from the beginning of the spring when they were the first or among the first to leaf out, and then among the first to flower, and then after their flowering, they began to set fruit. And now, here at the end of June, the fruits are by and large more red than green. And these berries are not edible. They are cathartic in every sense of the word. If you eat the red elderberry berry, you're going to find yourself in need of a place to go to the bathroom. Toilet paper will be required. It's a quick way to empty your bowels eating these fruits. And these are not to be confused with some of the other elderberries and currants, which are in that same group. This one, the red elderberry, it's strictly bird food. And if you want to encourage the birds to plant elderberry around your property, pull up a string nice and tight along your property line or wherever you want the elderberry to grow. And if there's an elderberry nearby and the birds are feeding on it, when they land on that string, they're going to leave behind some seeds and a little bit of nitrogen to help that seed get started. And you will have plenty of elderberries in a very short period of time.
For NPR, comes from the station. And from Vanguard. With Vanguard Investor Choice, investors can have a voice in how their eligible Vanguard funds vote on key shareholder matters. Learn more at vanguard.com/investor choice. From Integrative Therapeutics, maker of Cortisol Manager, a formula created by Integrative Therapeutics with the goal of supporting the body's natural stress response. Available at amazon.com. And from the Kauffman Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump says the reflecting pool at the Lincoln Memorial will be drained again. That's after its waters turned green with algae and pieces of its new coating peeled off in chunks. Trump accused vandals of damaging the pool, but experts point to the recent renovations as the more likely source of the problems. NPR's Rachel Treisman has been spending lots of time at the reflecting pool seeing all this play out, and she's with us now to tell us what she's been seeing. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning.
It seems like something new is happening with that reflecting pool every day. Where do things stand right now?
Right. Trump said on social media over the weekend that multiple people have been arrested for vandalizing the pool. Now, remember, the administration just spent more than $14 million to have it painted a darker blue. And it was just refilled earlier this month and then quickly turned green because of algae. On top of that, in the last few days, people noticed chunks of that blue coating drifting to the surface. So Trump says he met with contractors on Saturday, and they will probably have to, quote, drain much of the water for repairs.
Let me go back to these allegations about vandalism. There were arrests made. What do we know about that?
Truly not much. A Trump administration official with knowledge of the situation said that as of Saturday night, five people were arrested for vandalism. That official was not authorized to share details publicly. We also asked the U.S. Park Police and Department of the Interior for specifics, but haven't heard back. U.S. Attorney for D.C. Jeanine Pirro told Fox News on Sunday that vandals will face consequences.
There are several citations that have been handed out to individuals, and these are cases that will be prosecuted to the full extent.
One of those arrested is David Hearn. He's a Maryland resident and former U.S. Olympian. He was charged on Friday with destroying government property. But Hearn says he didn't do anything wrong. He says he got curious and just reached into the pool to touch one of the blue pieces that was already floating there.
Okay, so let's talk about this new coating, this expensive new coating. Why is it already starting to peel?
That's what I asked Steve Goodale, known online as Swimming Pool Steve, and he says there could be a bunch of contributing factors.
You have to consider environmental conditions and humidity and dust and contamination from other products that you're using.
Trump said on Truth Social that vandals had sliced a 250-foot gash in the pool's facade and poured corrosive chemicals in the water. But Goodale says that claim raises more questions than answers because of the strength of the coating that was applied to the pool.
Something that you would have to work pretty hard at, I think, to cause damage to it. If it's securely bonded to the substrate, that stuff is darn near impenetrable.
Another potential culprit is the hydrogen peroxide that Park Service workers poured into the pool last week. That was part of their efforts to kill the algae. Goodale says it's possible that those chemicals disrupted the bond layer between the surface and the coating, but it's hard to say without more data.
So if President Trump is saying the pool may have to be drained again, does that mean the algae could return?
Yeah, according to the experts I talked to, algae has caused problems in the reflecting pool over the years and very likely could again. The pool is, in general, a great environment for algae growth. It's shallow, it's stagnant, and it's in direct sunlight. And now that it's been painted an even darker color, it will absorb more sunlight. Goodale is hoping to see more precautions taken this time around. So, for example, flushing the pipes before turning the water back on. And of course, there's plenty of incentive for this administration to want the pool looking clean and blue as soon as possible, especially with July 4th less than 2 weeks away.
That is NPR's Rachel Treisman. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to a very different story. In Lebanon, children have paid a heavy price in the war with Israel. Lebanon's health ministry says at least 247 children have been killed and more than 1,000 wounded since Israeli airstrikes began in March. NPR's Jane Arraf and Jawad Rizkallah spoke with a surgeon treating war-wounded children. And here's a warning. This story contains audio of an injured child in distress.
Dr. Hassan Abusita is trying to soothe his young patient. Annabelle is 12, and she's been in hospital since she was wounded in an Israeli airstrike in April. She was hit by shrapnel near her home in southern Lebanon. The impact fractured her leg and ripped off soft tissue and nerves. She's had one operation already. Now she's not just in pain. She's so terrified that Dr. Abusita arranges for sedation so he can remove the dressing.
Injured child, quite traumatized. I need to take the back sponge off.
Annabella is with her mother, Sabrine, who asked NPR not to use their last names so they could freely discuss the impact of her injuries and treatment. Amid the sound of a vacuum dressing machine, her mother, a school teacher, encourages the girl to tell us what happened.
I was sitting on the bed. My dad came and told me that he wants to take me to the grocery.
Oh, the grocery store. Okay.
Then I wear my clothes and went with him.
They walked down the stairs and everything went black and you found yourself on the ground.
Yeah.
Her mother is wearing a neck brace. The blast sent a door flying into her. The family was displaced. The airstrike hit half an hour before the announcement of a ceasefire on April 16th between Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah.
Before we were packaging our things, our bags, waiting for 7 o'clock to the news to go back.
Dr. Abu Sitta, who's Palestinian-British, treated hundreds of children wounded in the war in Gaza. Israel bars him from going back there. Here, he says he sees some of the same patterns, including airstrikes on homes.
The wounded kids that are coming to us, we see them coming in families of wounded. And they're all in residential homes.
Israel says it uses precise targeting and takes care to avoid civilian casualties. But it does not explain why its strikes have killed and injured so many children. Dr. Abu Sitta says the Israeli killings of first responders in Lebanon, more than 125 of them so far, has also lessened the chances of wounded children surviving.
We know there are kids who've died being stuck in small hospitals that couldn't treat them and couldn't be moved.
He says all the injured children he treats are traumatized.
Because home is the safest place. And so that whole worldview of safety has been shattered.
War wounded children with injuries far beyond physical. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Beirut.
This is NPR News.
Surf's up!
As KAXE celebrates 50 years, we are looking back at the music from the year of our founding. This week's pick of 76 is Blondie's self-titled debut album. Blondie started as a club band, performing regularly at CBGB's and Max's Kansas City, both iconic clubs in New York City. They took this energy to their album with pounding drums, flashing keyboards, and guitars. Ken Tucker of Rolling Stone magazine described lead singer Debbie Harry as the possessor of a bombshell zombie's voice. While the album didn't make a splash on the new wave scene at first, songs like Ex-Offender, In the Sun, and Man Overboard set the stage for what's to come from Blondie. New York Isle is covered by gray. It's 7:43. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News. This week, Red Lake Nation's efforts to transfer back public portions of Upper Red Lake garnered support at the Minnesota DFL convention, and White Earth Nation expands the harvest from its bison herd. And 1 hour from now, it is What We're Reading with Tammy Bobrowski. Today, Tammy talks with debut author Meg Charlton. Her novel, Voyagers, is a story that explores memory and the enduring power of friendship at the end of the world. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low 70s, and tonight mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 40s to low 50s. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, partly sunny with highs in the low 70s. The Tuesday Summer Concert Series continues in Grand Rapids each Tuesday at noon. On June 23rd, Third Coast Chamber Collective artists and retreat participants will perform at the Alliance Church. And it's the 77th annual Paul Bunyan Days in Akeley, June 26th through the 28th. Enjoy live music and activities all weekend with a classic car show Saturday from 10 to 2 and the Grand Parade 1 o'clock on Sunday. Nielsen Spearhead Nature Preserve near Bemidji offers a variety of camps, workshops, and more this summer. Walk on the Wild Side is every second Saturday of the month at 8 a.m. We continue with Morning Edition on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Penn Medicine, committed to innovation since 1751. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine is working to change lives. From Bank of America, sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, dedicated to offering solutions to help businesses win, locally and globally. More at bankofamerica.com/gamechangers. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Extreme heat kills hundreds of people in the Phoenix metro area each year. When those deaths occur indoors, nearly a quarter of the time it's in a mobile home. That's in spite of the fact that mobile homes make up only 5% of area housing. From member station KJZZ, Catherine Davis-Young has more on why those risks are so high.
Hello, hello.
Hi, it's Red Cross.
It's a sunny Saturday morning, and volunteers with the American Red Cross are knocking on doors in a Phoenix mobile home park.
We just want to make sure you stay hydrated, check on a neighbor, and know that there's cooling centers nearby.
The Red Cross often provides relief after fires or hurricanes, but in this case, they're here to respond to heat, says Edgar Olivo, CEO for the organization's Arizona and New Mexico branch.
You're not thinking of it as a disaster. You're just thinking of it as a really hot day. It's just a dry heat. Those are the comments that we tend to hear.
Arizona summers have always been hot, but climate change is driving longer and more extreme heat seasons. And Olivo says as far as the Red Cross is concerned, this qualifies as a disaster. Heat kills more Americans annually than any other weather-related event. So the organization wants to help communities that face high risk, like the lower-income older adults who live in this mobile home park.
Senior citizens are exposed to a lot of the risks that come with extreme heat, especially if they're on medication, if they live in isolation, if they don't know where to go, should there be a power outage or some kind of emergency.
It's not only income and age that raise risk. Newer manufactured homes may be well insulated, but before 1976, there was no federal oversight of them. So older mobile homes may not have insulation or electrical systems that could support AC. The Urban Institute estimates there are more than a million of those pre-1976 units still in use nationwide, including tens of thousands in Arizona. And even if residents want to make upgrades, they often can't get financing to do so, says Mark Keir with the University of Arizona.
Most manufactured housing is not titled as real estate. It's titled as personal property, and it's very difficult to get money to make investments in it.
On top of that, these parks tend to have little shade and a lot of hard, heat-absorbing surfaces.
Which means that even if you have adequate air conditioning, it's going to be a greater financial burden for you to keep that home cool.
And many of these residents pay for electricity through their park, so they're not direct customers of utilities. Keir says that can make them ineligible for some forms of energy assistance. He says manufactured housing is an important, affordable option, but policies are making these homes vulnerable to climate threats.
These manufactured housing residents have really fallen through the cracks.
Last year, there were 25 heat deaths in these homes in Metro Phoenix.
We were just handing out information.
Back at the Red Cross event, volunteers are passing out information about how to recognize heat stroke and where the nearest cooling centers are. It's just after 10 a.m. and it's already above 90 degrees when volunteers knock on Joyce Craven's door. Her home is getting hot.
It's like a tin can.
She points to the bedroom window where a small air conditioner is mounted. It's the only AC she has and it doesn't cool the whole home. Her plan for the summer is just to stick close to it.
Just back there in the one room that has the window air conditioner.
The volunteers give her their information packet.
There are a lot of programs out there that are available to help.
They suggest she reach out to the city to see if she qualifies for home repair assistance or other help. She thanks them, and they head off to knock on more doors. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Davis-Young in Phoenix.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
it's A. Martinez from NPR's Morning Edition, here to wish KAXE a happy 50th anniversary. As the first rural public radio station in the nation, KAXE has proven that world-class public media can grow from small towns and deep roots. KAXE reflects northern Minnesota with reporting on local government meetings, student nature observations, and programs such as Green Cheese Trivia, On the River, and Headwaters that provide a curated music soundtrack every day. NPR is honored to celebrate KAXE and 50 years of rural storytelling, trusted local and national news and music.
You can do your part and keep KAXE going strong into the future. Become a member. Text the word donate, 218-326-1234.
Nothing's really something now, the whole thing's soot.
Negotiations are underway to end hostilities in the Middle East, but global businesses are skeptical.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the cars, trucks, and vans that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks. More at progressivecommercial.com. And by GEP, advancing autonomous procurement and supply chains with the AI-native GEP quantum intelligence software platform.
From Marketplace in Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams. Negotiations in Switzerland to permanently end the war in the Middle East have wrapped up for the day. Businesses around the world are keeping a close eye on those talks and are pretty pessimistic about how the war is affecting the economy. That's according to a new survey from Oxford Economics. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Businesses polled for the new Oxford Economics Global Risk Survey don't see things getting back to normal anytime soon. More than two-fifths think ship traffic through the Strait of Hormuz will stay below pre-war levels for the rest of this year and into 2027. And three-fifths think the Middle East will be a very significant risk to the global economy over the next 2 years. The survey respondents also think there's a nearly 30% chance of a severe or sustained disruption to the energy market if the Strait of Hormuz is basically closed until 2028. There is a little good news. The businesses in the poll now think there's less chance of a recession, but they still predict the global economy will only grow 2.2% this year. That's lower than the World Bank's projection. It cut its latest growth forecast for 2026 to 2.5% because of the war in the Middle East. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are down in the 0 to 2 tenths% range, with the Dow future down 19 points. The 10-year Treasury yield is up at 4.49%. Earlier today, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced he will step down as head of Britain's Labour Party and resign as Prime Minister. With that news, the FTSE in London is up 0.2%. Starmer is the sixth Prime Minister to lead the nation in the decade since Brexit.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bank of America, sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, dedicated to offering solutions to help businesses meet their goals locally and globally. More at bankofamerica.com/gamechangers. And by Wealth Enhancement, providing its wealth blueprint, planning for retirement and investing through national advisors. More information at wealthenhancement.com/build. And by Odoo.com, providing business management software with integrated programs for accounting, manufacturing, and operations. Odoo, all your business on one platform. Congress is working on a bipartisan bill aimed at addressing housing affordability by, among other things, making it easier to build homes. One provision would place limits on how many single-family homes companies and institutional investors can purchase. The idea is to prevent deep-pocketed investors with all-cash offers from competing with regular buyers. But investors say they aren't the problem. So who's right? Marketplace's Nova Safo visited Las Vegas, a city with a disproportionately high rate of institutional purchases, to learn more.
To answer that question, I wanted to first understand the scope of investor purchases in Las Vegas and the impact they've had. So I went on a ride-along with Congresswoman Dina Titus, whose district stretches from the glitzy casinos in the heart of town to suburbs in the north and south.
Well, this is a nice, fairly new middle-class neighborhood in Henderson, and I'm sure it's all single-family.
We're looking out on rows and rows of stucco homes, one or two stories, with tile roofs, all built at once as one development. There are many neighborhoods just like this around Vegas, and in some, a quarter of all homes are investor-owned, according to analysis by the University of Nevada. Titus, who supports some limits on investor purchases, says companies often crowd out potential homeowners.
All the numbers show that having a house is the key to building wealth. So if you can't find one to buy, you have to rent. That's not building your own personal wealth.
Titus says a decade ago, a hospitality worker at a casino with a union job would have been able to buy a modest home here. A worker like Samuel Delgado, a house person at the Bellagio.
I actually bought my house back in 2012.
I met Delgado as he was out canvassing for midterm election candidates, backed by his union, Culinary Workers Local 226. The union helped him with the down payment he needed to purchase his five-bedroom home.
I was very blessed to be a homeowner. My boys have a place to call home, have a backyard. Just, it feels great.
If you had to buy that home today, could you?
Absolutely not. I don't think at this time with the market price, if everything's skyrocketing, it'll be quite impossible for me.
Are prices up because of investors, or are investors here because home prices are accelerating? Experts say it's hard to know for sure. Nevertheless, in Vegas, homeownership is slipping farther away. Delgado says a lot of his neighbors now are renters in investor-owned homes. And they come and go, he says, as rents go up, making his community more transient than it otherwise would be.
The most impact is the children, because the children have to be located to school to school. And, you know, my boy's nine, so he gets friends here and there, and then he just sees his friends come and go due to the fact that they have to move out.
One of the people Delgado and I met as he was canvassing is 45-year-old Christopher Rice. He was out in the baking sun repairing his SUV.
Yeah, she's my old Jeep, man.
Yeah,
she's
cool.
A 5.2 liter, and she's a beast.
Rice said he's renting his home from an investment company, but he would rather buy.
I do. I am looking at this time. Me and the lady have worked on our credit for over 2 years. We are in that process.
The problem, he says, is that they can't find an affordable house.
Homes are, what, 325 to 450 easy.
Yeah. And that's out of your price range right now?
I can get a $325,000 home that's 50 years old and aging, needs plumbing, needs all kinds of work.
He's thinking of moving to another state instead. So would the investor limits Congress is considering actually help Christopher Rice buy in Las Vegas? The answer is complicated because researchers struggle to separate the bigger trends, interest rates, lack of supply, from any effects that might be caused by corporate purchases.
That's Marketplace's Nova Safo reporting from Las Vegas. Nova continues his story tomorrow, when we'll get perspectives from the housing investor side and explore what effect the policies lawmakers are considering in Washington might have in local communities around the country. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. A reminder that our Brainerd translator is operating at reduced power at 89.9 FM. We are waiting for some additional parts and a crew to complete this installation. We thank you so much for your patience. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News, and then Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Today we're going to hear about Ludwig, a blue jay that Laura rescued many years ago. And coming up at 6:45, we'll hear from Susie Saxhog-Loeffler from a live Stay Human storytelling event. Mostly sunny today.